Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here's some irony for you. The man most responsible for the scale and magnificence of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, that would be, ready for this, Jefferson Davis, the man who became president of the Confederacy during the Civil War. Another irony, the Capitol was built as a great symbol of unity at a time when the country was tearing itself apart in the 1850s and 1860s. We'll get the full story in just a moment. Later on this hour, we'll preview next week's sure-to-be-historic Supreme Court hearings on the National Health Care Reform Act, and Brian McTavish will swing by with his weekend to-do list. But first up, the building of our Capitol. With us is Guy Gugliotta. He's author of a new book, Freedom's Cap, The United States Capitol and the Coming of the Civil War. He's a former congressional reporter for The Washington Post. And Guy, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Welcome to Kansas City. Well, as a reporter who spent, I'm sure, you know, countless hours inside the Capitol building, Guy, what made you think to write about it?
Well, so it's 1998, and the Republican Congress is getting ready or trying to get ready to impeach President Clinton. It's a real nasty time, sort of like right now.
And, it's always nasty.
You got the Republican Congress trying to get rid of the Democratic president, just like they're trying to do now. And you got the Republican leadership falling apart at the same time. I think there were three speakers of the House in about that period. Anyway, I was covering the House Judiciary Committee, whose responsibility it was to get an indictment against President Clinton. And we'd been working like, 2 weeks straight and just exhausted. And finally, one day, the public relations person for Henry Hyde, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, sort of banged his hands on the table and said, okay, we're not going to do this anymore today. Why don't you come with me? He says, I want to take you on a tour of the Capitol. And it turns out that
He wanted to take you on tour.
Well, he was a Capitol buff. I mean, mm-hmm. He was really interested in the Capitol. A lovely guy named Steve Stratman. And anyway, he took us up two ladders. The first one went in between the inner dome and the outer dome of the Capitol, and took us deep up into the rotunda to a catwalk overlooking the rotunda. And said, well, step out and take a look at this. You can see right down on the floor of the Capitol Rotunda from here. And so once I got my death grip on the rail and looked down, I thought to myself, my God, this is incredible. Because this was a place I worked. I never really thought about it as a building. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So then next we went back downstairs, and then we climbed up this other ladder. And pretty soon we're on this catwalk 300 feet above the ground, just below the Statue of Freedom, which is on mm-hmm. top of the Capitol. And after I was sure of my death grip there and opened my eyes, I thought, my God, this is really something. And then that's when I learned that the modern Capitol, that's the two House and Senate wings that we have today, and the dome were built between 1850 and 1865, which seemed to me to be just an incredible thing because, you know, here's the most recognized symbol of Republican democracy in the entire world going up at the same time as the Republican democracy is just going straight down the tubes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, well, I got to find out more about this. And that's when I got into the project.
And so off you went.
Yeah. Well, yeah, pretty much. I didn't come back and write the book until many years later, but I always had it in my mind.
Well, reporters who spend so much time in Capitol buildings, you know, like myself, you develop these affinities for those buildings, Guy. What do you like most about the Capitol? Do you have a spot or a place that really is a favorite place in a massive building like that?
I've got a favorite spot and I've got favorite aspect of the building. I think the aspect of the building that just hypnotized me from the moment I started working there, and I worked off and on in Congress for about 6 or 7 years, was it was like becoming reacquainted with my childhood stamp collection.
Mm. Mm.
I mean, you'd go in and you'd look around and there'd be the picture of Oliver Hazard Perry on Lake Erie. You'd have this picture of Pocahontas, you know, dressed up like an Elizabethan wife. You'd have all these pictures that you hadn't seen any place in your life except on your postage stamps. And they were here, and these weren't prints. These were
the real
thing. These were the real thing.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And so that was one. And then my favorite spot in the Capitol is a absolutely just over the top, dazzling room called the President's Room. Mm-hmm. And it's
off the Senate, right?
Yeah, it's just mm-hmm. off the Senate. And it was fixed up, and Jefferson Davis had a big part in sort of picking out the decor. The idea was that at the end of a session, the president would come over when the Senate was working late, and he would sit at a desk in this room and sign bills as they were passed to save time instead of having to jump in a carriage and mm-hmm. come over periodically. And so Constantino Brumidi, the Italian fresco and wall painter, decorator, who did so many of the paintings in the modern Capitol, just went out of his mind in this place. And mm-hmm. it's just, you sit there today, and it's just shimmers. It's just so ornate and so dazzling. And it's just, as I say, it's so over the top, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I would like to spend some time in that room. I've always wanted to see the room where LBJ spent all his time on the phone, you know, working senators on the other side of the chamber. And then I've always also wanted to, when David McCullough was here, he talked about the famous sprint, I guess, that Harry Truman made when he ran from Sam Rayburn's hideaway office on the House side back to the White House when he got word. He didn't know what it was at that point, but FDR had just died. And
right.
McCullough actually recreated the run himself to get a feel for what it was like.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, it's well, you know, the place where LBJ signed his bills is now called the LBJ Room.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's where the Democrats do their caucuses. And it's right off, again, it's right off the Senate chamber on one side. And they have their caucus lunch every week on Tuesday afternoon. And then whenever they want to get together, they get together in the LBJ room. And when the Senate changes hands and the Republicans take control, they, of course, have the pick of the offices. But they're never going to go into any place called the LBJ room.
We're visiting with Guy Gugliotta. He's author of a book, Freedom's Cap, The United States Capitol and the Coming of the Civil War. You can hear Guy talk about his new book this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch. That's at 14 West 10th Street downtown. Just show up. You'll have a good time hearing Guy talk about this book. You know, a lot of listeners are going to be shocked, and I know that because I was, to read that Jefferson Davis, of all people, was the driving force behind the way that so much of this building appears today. Tell us about that. What role did he play, Guy?
Well, I don't think that the Capitol would exist as it does today without him.
That's amazing.
To tell you the truth.
The new president of the Confederacy was the guy who built the symbol of unity here.
Right, exactly. So it's 1850. He's a senator from Mississippi. Mexican war hero.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous states' rights and pro-slavery advocate, really nasty debater, really quick-tempered, looks like he's about to fly off the handle all the time, and does frequently. And other senators are sort of giving him plenty of space because they don't want to get him mad because he's really nasty when he's mad.
Mm-hmm.
So he is. He did as much as anybody to polarize the debate over slavery, both during the debate in 1850 and subsequently. But at the same time, he is has a tremendous nationalist vision, and this is very difficult to get at because it's very difficult to understand at a time when most politicians, I don't care if they were from the North or from the South, pro-slavery, abolitionists, whatever, were very, very wary of the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't like it. Didn't like coming to Washington.
Didn't
live in Washington. Mm-hmm. Stayed in boarding houses when they were down here and got out of town as fast as they could as soon as the gavel came down. They didn't like it here. They really didn't like spending money on the Capitol. And the idea of spending money to make the building bigger, they just couldn't get their mind around it. Davis had another idea. He had been in the Army, and like a lot of Army folks, he had a nationalist vision. He had a vision of the country, of what the country could be, because he'd been almost everywhere. He was from Mississippi. He'd lived in Kentucky. He'd lived in New York. He'd lived out on the frontier in Minnesota. He'd lived in Texas. He'd lived in Oklahoma. He'd been all over the place. And so he had an idea of what the nation could be. And during the debate to get the initial appropriation to start this project to expand the Capitol, at one point he wanted $100,000, and which was, you know, enough for a down payment, but not much more. And some senator challenged him, and he said, "Oh yeah, well, we give you $100,000, and next year you're going to come back and you're going to want $500,000. Then you're going to want $1 million, and we're going to keep spending money forever," which of course was true, and because that's the way it goes in Washington. But Davis, instead of denying it, just sort of looks at this guy and says, "Listen," he said, "you can give me $100,000 today. You can give me $500,000. But no matter how much money you give me, it will not be enough to build a building adequate to this government and this nation. Because at some point, there's going to be buildings all over the top of this hill."
Boy, talk about prescient. Wow.
I know, exactly.
Amazing.
Yeah, he knew. And the thing is that throughout the decade, right up until he left to become president of the Confederacy, he sort of juggled these two viewpoints. On the one hand, the rabid sort of states' rights guy, not scared of secession at all, on one hand, and on the other hand, the lone nationalist voice, you know, in a wilderness of local politics.
So this was the early 1850s. And where was the Capitol at that point? Where were they meeting? What was it like back in those days, Guy?
Right. Well, it's if you can visualize it in your mind, it's the center section, today's center section. And
Same place, same building, just the center part. Yeah.
Just the center part. And it had a Senate part, a Senate wing, and a House wing. And so the Senate met in this very intimate room. It was very good for debating. It had a couple of problems. And one problem was that it was very too hot, much too hot in the summer and much mm-hmm. too cold in the winter. Mm-hmm. And so the senators, many of them old guys, would sit and walk back and forth in front of these two stoves that were in front of the Senate, warming their behinds and driving Vice President Millard Fillmore, who was the president of the Senate as well, driving him crazy, and Fillmore couldn't stand that. Mm-hmm. And so when they weren't doing that, they were sitting in their chairs wrapped in buffalo robes or blankets. Sam Houston wore a Mexican poncho and a sombrero in the middle of winter. And if that didn't do it, there was this little bar called Hole in the Wall that they paid for out of their contingency fund, where you could go and have five or six belts of whiskey and then come back to the floor. So it was sort of a raucous place, and it was cold and unpleasant. And and the other thing that the Senate was known for, in fact, the whole Congress was known for, whereas that virtually every senator and congressman at that point either chewed plug tobacco or used snuff. And this drove Fillmore crazy, too, because somebody like Henry Clay, who was just this habitual snuff user, would be giving a speech, and then he would suddenly stop and say, "Page, bring me a pinch of snuff." And so Fillmore put in the habit of putting snuff boxes on the aisles so that the senators could get to them without stopping all the proceedings. But anyway, this was hardly ever mentioned. This was never mentioned that I could find in any memoir or anything written by an American. But any foreigner who came here was like the first thing that they noticed about the Senate. Charles Dickens came in 1845, and he said, "If you ever drop anything on the floor, make sure that you have a glove on before you pick it up."
It was that bad.
Yeah, it was pretty nasty.
Yeah.
And then the house, which is today's Statuary Hall, is the house was a beautiful room. Everybody agreed with that. But it was utterly unusable because it had these terrible acoustics, so that somebody speaking in front of the speakers well could be heard in a sweet spot like three quarters of the way across the room, but somebody five or six rows in front of him couldn't hear a word the person was saying. And so it was just utter bedlam.
And that's the same room where the press conferences are always held after a State of the Union address. And you wonder why they pick Statuary Hall, because it's just a cluster of reporters and cameras and people can't hear each other. And it's just nuts, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, it works very well for that these days, because what happens is that you can get right up close with the individual senators and congressmen in there, and so that you can have a conversation that only the two of you are having, because everything else is white noise. I mean, it's it's just chaotic in there.
What was the floor made of in the House and Senate chambers back in those days?
It was they were made of brick.
Hmm.
And brick floors, and they were retiled and carpeted during the expansion in the 50s.
And we were talking about Jefferson Davis being the visionary behind this building. You have a really interesting fact in this book, a guy. Did tell us about the time, or maybe it never happened, when Jefferson Davis did ever see the building completed, to see what he had done after the Civil War?
That's right. Yes, he when the war ended, he was on the run for I think about maybe a month or so, and then he was captured by cavalry and put in Fortress Monroe in Hampton Roads, Virginia. The suspicion was that he had helped set up the plot to kill Lincoln, and so that he was arrested for treason and thrown in jail, and while they tried to figure out what to do with him. Eventually, he got out on bail, and they just let him out on bail, and that was it, and and he went about his business. He never went back to Washington.
And never saw what he had done.
He never saw the completed Capitol, and because when he left, the dome was... the new dome was barely started, and he never saw it completed.
Well, let's jump ahead a little bit. You write about one of the key players in your story, the Capitol's lead architect, Thomas Walter. He returns to the Capitol at the beginning of July 1861. And when he found what you describe as an appalling mess. Why was the Capitol in 1861 an appalling mess?
Well, when the war began in April, there was total panic in Washington D.C. because this was a Union city, the seat of government of the National Union, and it's embraced by two slave states,
right.
Maryland and Virginia.
Virginia, right.
So the first thing that happens is that the first volunteer units that are all fixed up and ready to go, they come to D.C. to garrison. To garrison Washington, and I think the first unit was the 8th Massachusetts, which got to Baltimore, and pro-slavery, pro-Southern rioters wouldn't let the train proceed. So these guys had to get off and fight their way through the crowd and march from Baltimore to D.C. So they get to D.C. and the United States had like 10,000 person army. On the day the war started, and none of them were in Washington, D.C., and so they had no barracks, nothing at all. So there was only one place that they could put them. They put them in the U.S. Senate.
They put them there and put them there and put them there,
right? That's right. Yeah, they used it as a staging area for the first 4 or 5 months of the year, actually the first 3 months of the war. Like a unit would come in, and then they'd be sent off someplace. Somebody else would come in, and so you just had this sort of steady stream of people coming in and going out of the U.S. Capitol. They set up the bakeries where they were baking all the bread for the Army of the Potomac right there
in the basement, right?
Yeah, in the basement, and the soot was coming into the Library of Congress, which was in the Capitol at that time. And, you know, they didn't have enough bathrooms. They didn't have enough any place to store meat and other perishables. So they just dumped them in the rooms. And so Walter, the architect, comes back. And I guess he came back in July, or he came back before July. And he looked around and he said, oh, my God, you know, this is just awful.
The place was just a dump.
Yeah, they were wrecking the place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, thank God Lincoln called a special session of Congress to open on July 4th. and that forced the Army to find someplace else for its units. But the bakery was there for the rest of the year, and the Capitol was used for a hospital after First Bull Run and after Antietam the following year.
So the Civil War is going on. Troops are staying in the building. The building is uncompleted, right?
Right, that's right.
What caused Congress at the height of the Civil War to go ahead and appropriate money to get the thing done?
Well, I think what happens is that over the course of even the 1850s, you can see the idea of the Capitol and the idea of this majestic new Capitol taking root in Congress. And I think that's in part because it's the only thing they can agree on. And it's not controversial. Everything else has to do with slavery. So you can't build a transcontinental railroad. You can't you can't get Kansas into the Union. There's a whole bunch of things that you can't do. But one thing you can do is build this building. And the building becomes sort of a symbol of, you know, if we weren't getting ready to just blow the country away, this is what it might look like. And so there's a growing pride of ownership with the Capitol. So the war starts, and they stop the project right there, and they're not gonna resume it until after the war.
At this point, if readers listeners can imagine, the dome of the Capitol simply doesn't exist the way it does today, right? It's a completely different,
that's right,
different thing.
Yeah, well, no, there is no dome because they've taken down the old one and they've put up a semi-permanent one to protect it from the weather, and it's half built. And so the columns that you see there today, they're sticking up in the air, and some of them, but they're not all there. And so there's about two-thirds of the dome still to be done, and there's all kinds of stonework and stuff on the front that's still there. There's a lot that needs to be done. And so what happens is that they decide that they're going to stop and not resume it until after the war. But then Walter and a couple of his contractors, they come down and say, you know, this is a bad idea. And so they
a bad idea to
stop.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, because every day that you don't work on this, the weather beats it up worse. It the timbers rot. The decorations start to fall down. It gets messier and messier. But that's not the reason why you want to start this. The reason you want to resume building this is because it's the symbol of the country. And the thing is that by the end of 1861, beginning of 1862, all of the arguments about states' rights and this and that and the other thing, those are all out the window. And because the Congress that's in there now has decided that that this argument's over, and they're ready for the long haul, and they'll stay here forever. And chairman of the House Committee on Public Buildings and Grounds, or Senate Committee, says at one point during the debate over resuming the building, he said, you know, we can win this war and we can build this building at the same time.
Guy Gugliotta is our guest. His book, Freedom's Cap, United States Capitol and the Coming of the Civil War. Again, he speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street. Good chance to hear Guy talk about the book and the history of this fascinating building. How do they get the dome on the building then? There's some great engineering that went on to actually put on that very heavy cap on that building.
Yeah, exactly. This was an absolutely brilliant invention by the engineer who was the builder. He's a captain in the Army Corps of Engineers when he starts on the project.
Montgomery Meigs,
yeah.
Meigs.
Later becomes the Quartermaster General of the Union Army and basically one of the most powerful people in Washington. But at this time, he's just sort of he's what we would call today an early adapter. Boy, if there's a new gadget out there, he wants it. And so he was really enthusiastic about building the dome. And so the deal was, so how do you do it? And what he decided to do is that he didn't like the idea of scaffolding. Scaffolding it's expensive. It's dangerous, and you have to set it up, take it down, set it up, take it down. It's just a real pain. So he thought it through, and he decided on a new method of doing this. So he cut out the old dome, so there was just a hole, and then he ran this he got four timbers and bolted them together and stuck this mast way high out the hole and up into the sky, and then built a boom derrick on the top. And then instead of a scaffold, what people would do, they would climb this winding staircase. The workers would climb this winding staircase all the way up through the top to a platform, a movable platform that he had at the level that was being built at that time. And then, so what he'd do is that he'd have these cast iron pieces would be custom made and custom fitted, and then he'd have the winch on the derrick boost him up to where the workers could sort of manhandle him into place and bolt him there without worrying about scaffolding or anything.
So that cap was put on in pieces and all the way around.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And as they finished a layer, they lifted up the platform, you see, on the thing. Sound familiar? I mean, mm-hmm. It's exactly the way skyscrapers are built today. I don't know if he invented that or if it's the first time I've ever heard of it being of this method being used.
How much does that cap weigh
in the United States?
It's a crazy number.
It's something like 13 million pounds or something like that.
And, just incredible.
But the thing is, it's not nearly as heavy as it would have had to have been had it been made of masonry. And that's why it was able to be done.
So how much of the building, then, Guy, that we see today is the way it was back in 1870 or so when it was just newly completed at that point?
Oh, I think pretty much all of it.
Yeah.
All of it except the new foreground. None of the landscaping had been done. That was all done after the Civil War. And the newest landscaping was done when the new Capitol Visitor Center was put down into the basement. So that's new. But the building itself, the building, what you see today is what you got. In 1865.
Well, we are running short of time, but there's so much more to this book, including some of the politics that goes on, the infighting between Meigs and Walter that gets very intense at times. It's a very interesting book. Guy, I sure enjoyed having you today. Thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure, Steve. It was a pleasure.
That's Guy Gugliotta. He's author of the book Freedom's Cap, The United States Capitol, and the Coming of the Civil War.